You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
You got to feel a little bad for William Crawford because he did everything right. Everything you need to do if you're seeking the presidency in the early 19th century. Good resume, good message, nice ideological discipline. And then some upstart comes along and changes all the rules. The current president of the time we're talking about, 1824, is James Monroe. And he's president because Crawford sort of stood out of his way. After Thomas Jefferson and then James Madison, you reach 1816, and you had two Virginians in a row as president. And there's already complaints of too much Virginia. Crawford is from Georgia. He's an ambitious man. He's part of a new generation. That's right, he's born in 1772, too young for the actual fighting of the Revolution. You can't call him a millennial or even a centennial. No, I mean, he's 28 and the century turns. Raised in a free United States, he's smart with finances. He's been an ambassador, been a senator, secretary of war. He challenges Monroe's succession to the presidency. He does so by playing by the rules at the time. And that was, you go to the party's congressional caucus. That's right, a vote of the members of Congress to decide who everyone in that party is getting behind for president. A meeting in a room in Washington City. That's how it's decided then. Just as Monroe had done in 1808. Monroe had challenged Madison, and when Monroe lost, he didn't flinch. He serves in Madison's cabinet, knowing that he'd probably be next. That's how it's done. He is next, and in 1816, Crawford challenges Monroe. And he's got a few supporters. He could make it a ugly, bitter fight in that congressional caucus, but he kind of lays off. Monroe wins. But Crawford establishes himself with the challenge, and he becomes Monroe's Secretary of the Treasury and a proponent of fiscal discipline, stomping down the plans for grand national roads and canals. And where he can, he's trimming budgets, biding his time, waiting for the next congressional caucus. No one opposes Monroe in 1820. This is the so-called era of good feelings. The two parties, the Federalists and the Republicans back then, were mostly gone, because everyone was a Republican now after the World War of 1812. Era of good feelings. Well, Jimmy Monroe tours New England the same way George Washington did after his presidential victory. A Virginian visiting Massachusetts again. Who's there to welcome him? All the old Federalists in Massachusetts, especially John Adams. And John Adams will stand the former president as an elector in his 1820 election. No one opposes Monroe. There are no parties anymore. It's just a good old American era of good. And if you believe that, you need to close the textbook. There are still policy differences, still regional differences, still political machines, and still a plenty of ambition across the continent. But there's rules. There must be rules, right? And Crawford is following those rules. So in 1824, well, really starting in the year before in 1823, he lines up support for his presidency. That should be his, in the body that will decide at the Congressional Caucus. And he knows he has a powerful ally here, Martin Van Buren, the political magician of Albany, New York, Dutch town at the top of the Hudson. He's going to line up support for a regular Orthodox Republican, not one of these new Republicans who came from the Federalist Party, these quid Republicans who wear a commoner's hat and dine with the aristocracy anyway. No, a regular Republican. Van Buren's bucktails, these are the people that support him, control New York right now, and they'll pick the electoral votes. Because New York still chooses its electoral votes through the state legislature. There are some winds of change, yes, sniping at the idea of the Congress picking the president. A self-created central power, sneered Senator Rufus King, echoing many newspapers at the time, that this caucus system must be destroyed. Because in 1824, something interesting now is happening. 18 of the 24 states in the Union will allow the people, not all of them, not New York, not South Carolina, not a few others, but 18 of the 24 will allow the people to pick the electors. Yes, free white men at this time, but still an advancement over the previous systems. But no matter, the caucus is still the caucus. Crawford will win it. It's his turn. Something else is different, too. There's a lot of people who are running for the presidency right now. Tradition, not law at this time, will compel James Monroe, the current president, to give it up. He's had his two terms. But others want to jump in. And you start with Secretary of State John Quincy Adams. Highly regarded, son of a president, negotiated a treaty with Spain, controversial, but he did it well. Crawford and Van Buren consider Adams a crypto-federalist. But it's probably unfair. Adams stood by Republicans in the embargo issue of 1808 when the rest of the New Englanders were against it. He was a traitor to his former party then. That built credibility, helped negotiate the Treaty of Ghent on behalf of the Madison administration after the War of 1812, now serving as James Monroe, the Virginian Secretary of State, New England and Virginia, working together just as his father had helped pick Washington. The job that Adams holds is also the job that Madison had had before he became president. It's the job that Jefferson had had before he became president. It's one of the jobs that Monroe had had before he became president. Plus, John Quincy Adams from New England, a rich area in electoral votes. There's no other Northerner running. DeWitt Clinton of New York from that famous Republican family in New York ran for president in 1812, angered everyone and lost. Then got thrown out of the governorship in New York in 22. He's no competition right now. He's on the downslide in his state. He'll come back up. But in 24, he's not a force to be reckoned with nationally. Adams has no competition for the Northern votes. He sews up New England. He probably has New York. And the region New England is aching for someone from their area to become president. There have been four Virginian presidents, one New Englander, in the history of the Republic up to this point. And there's been three Virginian presidents in a row. That means three Southerners in a row. It's time for a New Englander. Yes, you can make a case for John Quincy. Regional differences right now are strong. Maybe there's good feelings on the partisan side, maybe. But regional differences are strong. Southern newspapers attack the idea of a Yankee universal nation they feel the New England wants, with a sectional magistrate, person from one region ruling on behalf of them. The Nashville Whig sums up how Southerners feel sometimes about New England. The whole mass of New England entertains notions very inadequate to our merits. They think meanly of our intellectual improvements and our moral conditions. In other words, they look down on us. Here's what the Delaware Gazette says. No man who will attempt to excite local prejudices and sectional feeling, as Mr. Adams has done, should ever be elected president. A paper in Alabama said, its candidate would be the president of the whole people, the enlightened ruler of an undivided empire, not a sectional magistrate. The Argus of Western America bemoans the lack of representation for the whole region of the West. While a coastal Southern paper calls for an Atlantic party that can spare them from the growing power of the West. Regions are still defining a lot of the politics of people, and a lot of voters are going to vote according to where they stand. Adams isn't immune to this logic. He's going to try to seek someone to run with, from the South perhaps. And he also knows that he's got the Electoral College advantage. No matter what the others do, because they're going to split the region, and he's got his region lockstep. Speaking of regions, the West has never had a president yet. And while not populous, not rich, all of the growth, all of the excitement of the new republic is from the West. And the Speaker of the House, Henry Clay of Kentucky, would very much like to get his hands on the White House. He's a card player, bourbon drinker, swearer, arm twister. But he's just got the Missouri Compromise done, giving him national cred, savior of the Union. But annoying those South who support slavery strongly and those North support abolition strongly, neither of whom wanted a compromise. That's going to limit how many popular votes he's ever going to get. His little political abracadabra in the Missouri Compromise, a series of votes, not just one, with different House members voting in different ways on different votes, culminating in a compromise. His little abracadabra had the advantage of, poof, creating a new state, Missouri, which, yeah, thanks to him pretty much creating it, was probably going to go for Henry Clay in 1824 if he ran. And of course, he could count on his home state. Clay is pro-improvements, high tariff. He wants what's called an American system. It's a popular idea at the time and had a lot of support in the West and in the North. The idea was you want to protect the infant industries of America, principally North. How are you going to do that? Well, you're going to have a high tariff to prevent imported goods from coming in or to make it more difficult. Protect your budding industries. And then the government's going to get a lot of income. What are you going to use it for? Roads and canals, federally supported out West. Policy-wise, this puts him near Adams, but he can read the cards. He's no Mr. Popular. He plays well in Congress. If he can just get the election thrown there to the House of Representatives, oh, it's pretty much Mr. Clay's White House. There's another candidate to speak of, but not for very long. Mr. Calhoun, John Calhoun, from South Carolina, the Secretary of War, also has a plan. He's got backing, of course, in his home state of South Carolina, and also he's got friends in Pennsylvania. With those two states, he's got a little game. Not much, but maybe if some others drop out. That is, count it, three candidates running from the cabinet of the same administration. And yes, there's going to be plenty of bickering in Monroe's second term as he tries to keep peace and order between these people fighting. Crawford, the Treasury Secretary, believes in small budgets. He's going to snip at the budget for state. He's going to snip at the budget for war. That'll bring about the complaints of both Adams and Calhoun. You've got one candidate from the Congress. Everybody running is a presence in Washington City. Well, this is a funny time for that to stand because 1819, you have a huge economic panic. People are mad at the administration. They're mad mostly at the banks. They're mad at their state governors. They're upsetting various state governments. Anti-bank politics are strong. They're mad at the Second Bank of the United States. Out of this mess comes a new figure, nominated only by the Tennessee legislature. Who are they? A Western legislature to pick a president of the United States? Yet the hero of New Orleans, General Andrew Jackson's name emerges. Now, he's had a bit of misfortune in the 10 years since he blocked the British from taking New Orleans in 1814. There are lingering complaints about how he handled martial law in that city. He's been battling in his own state with the political machine there. And he's assigned to Florida by the Monroe administration. He battles with Indians there, enters Spanish territory, kills British citizens. And this leads to a censure from Monroe and to an embarrassing congressional investigation. This steams the general, and he's looking at anybody responsible in a way to get back. Yet something else is going on. In his home state of Tennessee, Andrew Jackson is embroiled with John Overton, the owner of two of the largest banks in the state and the controller of the state's political machine. Overton is not so popular. After his friends in the legislature enacted state laws that would protect his banks. This while many small businesses, farmers were ruined by the paper money crisis. There are papers calling him a horse leech. Usually Overton's going to determine who gets to be governor. But in the politics surrounding the popular uprising over the panic of 1819 and the recession of 1820, Overton's choice for governor is thrown out, and a man who had served with Andrew Jackson becomes governor. Andrew Jackson sees that Overton is unpopular, and you have to understand that in the past, Jackson had worked with Overton and his machine at different times. But he sees how unpopular he's getting. He opposes him. He opposes any kind of bank paper money schemes. Comes out hard on the anti-bank side. Well, Overton sees what he's doing, and he says, okay, General Jackson, I'm going to block your friend's appointment to the U.S. Senate. Gets another candidate. Lines up the votes in the state legislature, and they're the people that elect senators at this time. Andrew Jackson and his friends come up with a plan. The general himself will run for U.S. Senate, and he appears before the Tennessee state legislature the night before and speaks to them and wins the vote overwhelmingly. He is now U.S. Senator from Tennessee. Well, people are looking at this. After that panic of 1819, there are four people now in the presidential race, and none of them has any credibility opposing the Bank of the United States. Calhoun was a bank supporter. Adams was pro-bank from the very beginning. Crawford was Treasury Secretary and worked closely with the government's bank. Clay used to be the bank's lawyer. So you've got nobody who has credibility on this issue. So it's in 1822 when the paper of longtime Democrats, anti-bank people in Philadelphia, the Aurora, edited by William Duane, floats Andrew Jackson's name for the presidency. And they follow it with raucous public meetings and demonstrations in Philadelphia. We know of no other Hercules, one convention says. A newspaper, the Columbian Observer, forms and fills Philadelphia's streets with populist printings, all pro-Jackson. He would be a second George Washington, one who would free the country of the corruption and protect the productive classes. So said the paper's editor, Stephen Simpson, a man who held his rifle alongside Jackson at New Orleans. Oh, but you can't do that, said the professionals of Philadelphia politics, including the machine that currently held the city. A general? What does he know? The Pennsylvania political class was for Calhoun at this time. Jackson's supporters were just the grog shop politicians of the villages, the rabble of Pittsburgh, the giddy young men of Philadelphia. And as to all these demonstrations and meetings, one of the Calhoun supporters says, you can't win with effervescence. Yet by winter 1823, Calhoun is the first victim of this new populist campaign. He drops out when he cannot win the Pennsylvania Republican nominating convention. He settles for the vice presidential nomination. Meanwhile, things are getting pretty bad for Crawford. The Treasury Secretary, he's on that cutting spree. He's angering. Adams thinks that he's a worm feeding from within the government. He's suffering from most of these populist attacks. They're aimed at Crawford, who is, for the supporters of Andrew Jackson, the main rival to beat. And something else. Crawford's prescribed medication that produces a paralytic stroke. Right at the key season for the presidential election. This makes him the original low-energy candidate. He does manage to get back to work, but it takes some time. These rumors that he would be completely unavailable for the presidency affect the political action. Yet Van Buren insists on holding that old institution, the Republican Congressional Caucus, to decide on who's going to be the orthodox Republican candidate. You might say, this is a meeting of the very Republican establishment of 1824. Crawford wins overwhelmingly. There's only about 4 votes against him.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Except that more than half of the congressmen do not show up to the caucus. This is now seen as an anti-democratic device broadly among the American people and in the states. People want either meeting of state party leaders or hopefully political conventions in each state that will nominate people for the presidency. The idea of a primary or a national convention even is pretty far off. Meanwhile, in the spring of 1824, a series of letters appear by an author named Wyoming, but you never used your name at this time. It's actually the Senator John Eaton, a supporter of Andrew Jackson. They appear in the Columbian Observer in Philadelphia. That was the paper created for Jackson. But they are, you might say, retweeted in newspapers all around the country. The message: the nation has drifted from its moorings. We are not as we once were. The people are slumbering at their post. Virtue is on the wane, and the Republican principles which we set out are in fast decay. In other words, let's make America great again. And the way to do it, the paper concluded, was to elect Andrew Jackson. There's more of a slap at both Crawford and Adams. Jackson's rivals may have spent more time in Europe. They may know how people eat and sleep in Paris and London. To wider heads, and to those conversant in the sublime science of dancing, it is good for the choice of chief magistrate to know whether he is to bow with the left or the right foot forward. I want to man my countrymen at the head who will throw such trifles off. Mostly it's aimed at Crawford. They're not going to stop from attacking Adams, but mostly this is aimed at Crawford. There's an interesting dance that occurs. Here's what one of the Wyoming letters say about Adams. He's not as subject to intrigue as some of our cabinet members. Well, with Calhoun in the vice presidency now, there's only one other cabinet member running, so that's aimed at Crawford. But they won't resist a little jibe at Adams. But he's a closet man. And the letters say, you don't know where his politics really are, and you might say that because he's his father's son, maybe that's where they were, or some think that's where his politics go. They also say he's an efficient man of letters, and we cannot doubt his literary achievements. These are all faint praise designed to sort of attack. And there's an interesting strategy that even Adams employs. He has already told good friends, like his good friend William Plummer, that he respects Jackson and thinks that all this talk that Jackson is hot-tempered and all that is a lie, that he's really very even-tempered and a very solid person. He could even be a choice for the presidency. 1824, he invites Jackson to an event, Adams does. Hints that he might like him for the vice presidency. Jackson gives Adams no assurances whatsoever. A Rhode Island writer writing for Adams, obviously that's the way you did it, through surrogates, obviously the Adams message, promised that he would not denigrate any of his man's opponents and would treat them all with that high respect that is due to men who are honored by the people. Jacksonians in New Jersey also went out of their way to kind of praise Adams. His knowledge as a diplomat and his abilities as a writer have often been exercised with honor to himself and benefit to his country. Everyone has to be careful here in 1824. See, there's a bunch of candidates. This hasn't really happened this way before, and the thing could end up in the House. This is on everyone's mind if no one gets a majority of the electoral votes. So you could attack, but not too much. You had to think ahead. The election happens, and of course, it's not a one-day affair. It's in many places. It's over a series of months that states pick the Electoral College. And it occurs between October and December. In some places, it's placing paper ballots into a box. In other areas, it's an oral vote before a magistrate. The whole state of Kentucky, for instance, votes that way. In 18 of the 24 states that allow the people to pick the electors, Andrew Jackson wins most of them. Illinois, Indiana, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, North Carolina wins them overwhelmingly. New Jersey's a little close. Adams holds New England, wins that area just as overwhelmingly, wins Massachusetts, wins Maine, one elector goes to Jackson, wins Connecticut, New Hampshire, Rhode Island. Clay wins his home state of Kentucky, Missouri, and also gets Ohio, his region. But Jackson comes in a strong second in all of those states. Crawford, despite his stroke, despite all the attacks on him, wins his home state of Georgia, and not much of a surprise, the center of the Republican Party establishment right now, Virginia. That leaves a few states that still choose their electors by the state legislature. Clay has friends in Louisiana, and he's hoping to get those votes. But there's some issues, not the least of which, there's a freak carriage accident that stops two of his supportive state legislatures from voting in the election, and a few more don't vote for him in Louisiana because, get this, there's a rumor that Clay is withdrawn from the race, so they don't think he's eligible to vote. And this is something that happens, and it's not often seen. The election of 1824 in history is seen as, oh, it was Jackson got more votes, Adams came in second, and Adams won the presidency. But in Louisiana, and we're going to talk about it in a bit, in New York, there was actually collusion between the Adams and Jackson state legislatures in how they would divvy up the electoral votes. So they do that in Louisiana. In New York, all of Van Buren's political magic doesn't work that well. There's been a state election since Van Buren first proposed Crawford, and DeWitt Clinton is back. He's offended the Clinton political machine. The political machine has attempted to take the vote away from the state legislature so that the electoral votes, just like in those other 18 states, will be chosen by the people. Van Buren's able to get that blocked. But in doing so, in voting against the election bill, he's hurting his chances. So when it gets to the state legislature, once again, the Adams and Jackson folks collude. Jackson picks up electoral votes. New York goes 26 for Adams, 5 for Crawford, 1 for Jackson, 4 for Clay. The Adams vote is partially the result of a new force in politics, a young editor named Thurlow Weed. He's going to have an impact in Republican, Whig, and then the 1854 Republican Party in presidential elections. Weed is going to be active for more than 40 years. You're going to hear that name again. So the election in the Electoral College goes Jackson 99, Adams 84, Crawford 41, Henry Clay 37. The end result is what some expected, what Clay desperately wanted, what Jacksonians feared, what Adams considered, what Crawford never could possibly imagine, and what the framers of the Constitution prepared for. No candidate received a majority of the electoral vote. And the presidential selection went to the House. Now, the Constitution is ready, and it's been amended since the beginning of the Republic. It's been amended for the 12th time in 1804. The 12th Amendment says there's no majority in the electoral votes. The presidential choice goes to the House. And the congressmen, voting as state delegations, not as individual members, vote for the president. That means Delaware gets one vote, and so does the very populous Virginia. Now, the 12th Amendment also says that the Congress must choose among the three top electoral vote-getters. This is a change. When the Constitution was first drafted, it was five. Now they want it among only the top three. This means that Clay's inability to win anything out of the bordering states of his home state, Kentucky, and Missouri, Ohio, that he couldn't get more votes in New York as planned, means that he's not in the running. It's between Adams, Jackson, and Crawford. I mean, you just can't pick Crawford. So it's between Adams and Jackson. Now, Clay isn't in, but he is in the catbird seat. He remarks to friends how popular suddenly he is in the winter of 1824 and 1825. How can one withstand all this disinterested homage and kindness, Clay says. The Jackson people are going to him and saying, oh, you know, Henry, you were always our second choice. We do want a Westerner, and you want a Westerner, don't you? You know, Jackson came in second in Kentucky, Ohio, and Missouri. So it's logical. They know that Henry Clay, as the Speaker of the House, can influence this election greatly. Kentuckians, Tennesseans, should be united. We're certainly not going to vote for that Yankee Universal president.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious Podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
The Kentucky legislature instructs its congressional delegation, this would include Speaker Clay, to vote for Jackson. This makes Henry Clay sick, but it doesn't matter. Clay and his allies in Congress don't report to the state legislature. They report to the people of Kentucky directly. Clay's popular in Kentucky. He's going to continue to be popular in Kentucky. They'll vote for who they darn please. Clay's pretty much decided that it just can't be Jackson. And killing a couple thousand British people, he says, that doesn't qualify one for the highest office in the land. He's really afraid of a military general taking over the civilian office. And it's during a reception in New Year's, which the great General Lafayette, French general from the Revolution, had visited the United States. It's 1825, it's the 50th anniversary of the first shots fired in the Revolution. So Lafayette is here in the United States, touring the country. He's nearly 70 right now. He's visiting everyone, Jefferson, Adams. Adams and Clay have a talk. We don't know what they said, but from Adams' diary, Clay says that in the contest between yourself and Jackson and Crawford, I very much prefer you. Now there's rumors spreading. Stephen Simpson, writing in the Columbia Observer, notes these rumors before Clay even says anything. He reports that there's a rumor that Adams is going to make Henry Clay Secretary of State in exchange for his votes. And that Henry Clay said something to Adams like the Swiss, we will fight for those who pay the most. And so there's a great uproar when the Kentucky congressional delegation declares they will vote for Adams. Adams didn't receive any popular votes in Kentucky. It was Clay and then Jackson. When Adams tells James Monroe he would like to appoint Henry Clay as Secretary of State and Henry Clay has accepted, there is an uproar. It is, according to Andrew Jackson's nephew, a corrupt bargain that has been struck. The Judas of the West has closed the contract, Andrew Jackson tells friends. Clay might get a bad rap in history. His politics, how he'd always been on record, was closer to Adams than Jackson. He's pro-bank, he's pro-tariff, pro-improvements. He's going to have fights with Jackson throughout his presidency. With Clay in support and all of Adams' New England support that he gets, Adams obviously wins that election in the House easily. Henry Clay is made Secretary of State, and he serves for 4 years. Adams serves for 4 years. It's going to do a couple of things. One, this very fractious time that we talked about in this part of American politics is going to coalesce, and there's going to be two parties. In 1828, it's going to be Adams versus Jackson. And even though a lot of Jackson's ire is still aimed at Clay for this deal, there's not going to be the niceties that occurred in 1824 between Jackson's and Adams. It's all out. You're going to see the basic structure of two parties kind of come back. The Adams faction is going to become the Whig group, and the Jackson faction is going to become the Democrats. It is true that within this, particularly on the issue of slavery, there's always going to be divides, and that's why 1854 is a larger moment. But the large base of the Republican Party that forms in 1854, that anti-Nebraskan party, is going to be from the Whig movement. 1824 is the last election where it was necessary to use the device of sending an election to the House of Representatives. I do think, given the amount of time the framers of the Constitution put into the procedure for selecting the president that they probably anticipated more votes going to the House of Representatives. After all, it's a majority of the Electoral College that's required, not a plurality. And that their inability to think about parties and party mechanisms and how things would go led them to probably think that elections would go to the House more often. Received a tweet not too long ago, and you can tweet me at myhist, at myhist. Maurice Cheeks writes, "Hi Bruce, fan of the show since 2007. Suddenly very interested in hearing a cast about now versus 1825. Cheers." Okay, thanks Maurice. Well, you want it, you get it. I do think it's interesting. Look, I'm a big proponent of history does not repeat itself, it rhymes. So there are things that are similar, and you can see interesting little patterns. I mean, I was amazed just to hear about the kind of faking that a candidate isn't running anymore to get votes, and I imagine how much that happened in the past, but it does not mean that this is 1825. I don't think that an election goes to the House, even if an independent runs, and I'll tell you why I think that, because the two modern elections where you had at least a three-way, and that was 1980 and 1992. I know 92 is a little controversial, but at least with 1980, it doesn't send the election to the House. It amplifies the win. Most of the elections we've had, electoral vote wins have been pretty big. There's only been a few close ones. So I tend to think a third-party challenger amplifies wins versus sending an election to the House. 92 is something of controversial because, you know, not everyone thinks that some think that Perot cost Bush the election. I do not. Clinton was at 50%, I'll say it again and again, 50% in October when Perot got back in the race. But he did, I think, serve to amplify Clinton's win in certain states. Regional differences aren't as big, although they're there. Possible to run a national campaign now. That's what I think happens. I don't think it gets thrown into the House. But if it does, well, you have something from 1824. The other thing I think you can learn a little bit from 1824 is the beginning of a large popular movement, the beginning of groups of people nominating candidates instead of a group meeting in Washington. I do think you see some interesting dynamics, is that whether or not people agree with me that they don't think the election will go to the House, politicians have to consider it. And so there's weird dynamics that go if you get three or four people in a presidential race as to how you're going to treat each candidate, because you might end up having to work with them in coalitions. And finally, I mean, obviously, an election going to the House would be a huge boon to the GOP. And I think candidates entering will think about that if they don't want the GOP to win. Because you send it to the House, you have Republican leads, and most of the state delegations will be Republican. So Speaker Ryan and a few others will be controlling that choice. Website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Thanks for listening.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.